no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk. My guest today, Lauren Anderson, is one of the most admired women ever to climb up the senior ranks of the U.S. national security apparatus. Starting out as a junior FBI special agent, her obvious grit and determination won her a spot as the first woman on an FBI SWAT team. She was also the first woman to lead FBI offices in France and Africa, covering 22 countries on that vast continent, then led the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York City. Two very big firsts. Today, she serves on many nonprofit boards working to make the world a better, safer place, as well as on the U.S. Government Comptroller General's Advisory Board, which oversees the work of the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, Congress's watchdog agency. She's also in constant demand as a keynote speaker around the world in forums ranging from Azerbaijan to Ukraine and many places in between. So we're lucky and honored to have her here today to discuss the radical, by all accounts, radical changes coming to not just the FBI, but the CIA, ODNI, Pentagon, and Justice Department under the incoming second Trump administration. Lauren Anderson, it's just an honor to have you on the Spy Talk podcast. Thank you so much for coming and speaking with us today. Now, we want to talk about the current FBI and especially how it may look after the Trump administration comes in and if Kash Patel, who has been militantly anti-FBI, becomes its director. But first, I want to ask you, why did you join the FBI after graduating from Muhlenberg College?
That's a great question. And I would say that the signs were all there when I was a kid, but it took me a while to realize it in terms of what interested me. And there were a couple of drivers. One was service. Service was something that was very important to me from my childhood onward. Second, I was fascinated by all things global. At the time, the Cold War was in full swing. So the idea of getting to be involved with countering espionage activity, terrorism activity was all incredibly interesting to me. And I also looked at it, in addition to serving, as a way to continue to learn, because I am an incredibly curious person who doesn't have a good day if I haven't learned something new. So I felt that that service in a really interesting job gave me that opportunity to contribute both professionally and grow personally and professionally.
Well, not to go on forever about this, but you sound like a real nerd. I mean, in the sixth grade or whatever, you know, I mean, you're talking about counter-espionage. I mean, in my era growing up, and I'm significantly older than you, I think it's safe to say, you know, there were you could become a junior G-man under J. Edgar Hoover, get some little badge in the mail, maybe with a cereal box top. I'm not sure. But the FBI was about crime solving back then when I was a kid. But you grew up in an era where counter-espionage, catching spies was an allure for you joining the FBI?
Yeah, you got to remember that I also was growing up at a time when there were shows on TV like the FBI, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. So I was getting exposed as a child to things like that, which I loved. And when I was in high school and college, the whole notion of profiling criminal activity was beginning to come into its own. And that was also fascinating. I couldn't read enough about Ted Bundy and other serial killers. And the FBI just began work on that as I was finishing college. So in addition to the nerdy espionage and counterterrorism work, I was fascinated by the notion of profiling and ultimately wound up learning from the guys who started all of that and spending a number of years of my career doing that as well.
Huh. I think it's fair to say that the FBI lived up to your expectations.
It absolutely lived up to my expectations. It allowed me to do a lot of things that I couldn't have done. I tried out for the SWAT team and made it as one of the first women on a SWAT team. But interestingly, wow, that was driven more about me wanting to improve my tactical skills so that the guys felt confident with me on the street, and moving onward from there. But I absolutely loved it. I learned to speak French thanks to the FBI. I had the opportunity to run offices for the FBI in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, and open new offices in Africa. And I could have not foreseen that when I was 11 years old.
So you could kill in a half dozen languages, as they say. You rose to very senior levels in the FBI. I dare say you were a pioneer of sorts among women agents. I've known a number of FBI agents quite well over my 40-plus years of covering the Bureau on and off. Some of them became very good friends of mine, and they were all conservative. I dare say they were Republicans. Were you conservative in some way, or did you identify as a Republican? I'm going to get around to talking about today's FBI.
Actually, I did. I was a bit of a hybrid because as I came of age in terms of voting, my national level perspectives on politics were more conservative and far more in the vein of the Republican Party at that time. But socially, more liberal, to be sure. So I was a perennial ticket splitter in terms of how I voted locally and how I voted nationally. But in terms of my affiliation with the Republican Party, it was huge. I, in high school, was the treasurer and Ways and Means chairman for Teenage Republicans for the state of New Jersey.
Ah, and I dare say that, I keep saying I dare say, but I'm going to dare say that most of your colleagues, as you rose up through the Bureau, were the same, if not Republicans in name, were very conservative.
I would agree with that assessment. There were exceptions, but in terms of the agent population, that actually was an interesting split to me. The agents were, not to a person, but pretty much the majority sitting on the conservative side. But the non-agent population, our professional staff, who are extraordinary people doing all kinds of jobs, they were a real mixture. I thought they were much more reflective as a body of our society rather than all sitting on a more conservative side as a lot of the agents did. And that, to me, was an interesting dichotomy in the Bureau population.
So this brings us to the present day. How do we go from that to Republicans branding the FBI as an organization that's conspiring against them? I just came upon a New York Times story this morning that said that Kash Patel, who has called the FBI a threat to the people, he's, of course, Trump's nominee to run the FBI, he got a warm welcome from Republicans on Capitol Hill this week. What do you make of that?
That's not surprising to me. I mean, the FBI, one of the jobs that I did during my tenure was working with the Hill on the Congressional Budget Justification Book for everything national security related for the FBI. So I dealt extensively with HPSI and CISI and to a lesser degree with the Judiciary and HAC. However,
let me just stop you there. For people who aren't read into the acronyms, HPSI, yeah, and CISI, that's the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, the Oversight Committee on the House, and CISI is the acronym for the Senate Intelligence Committee that oversees, CIA, FBI, et cetera.
So at that point in time, and I watch my own acronyms going forward, at that point in time, we generally were well-received when we went on the Hill. I dealt with both staff and members, and we were well-received, but there were tough questions. And even back then, Chuck Grassley was on the Hill, and he has, for the entire tenure of his career, as one example, been particularly tough on the Bureau. But what I found interesting in dealing with the Hill is our engagement in a one-on-one or a small group setting versus what got said publicly, and this is not going to be a surprise, was very different. So not that there weren't hard questions, there were, but that personal sort of interaction and the belief that what they were hearing was accurate and that they could trust was there. But oftentimes when they step before the cameras, and this goes for both sides, when they step before the cameras, things got much sharper in tone. And that is a part of the nature of their job. And we understood that, although in the beginning it was particularly frustrating to me because I'm somebody who's all about getting the right information out, not with my opinion, but just literally, what are the facts? Here are the facts. Here's where there's things that are great. Here's where things need to improve. And that throughout my tenure at the FBI, whether I was an agent or an executive and with whomever I dealt, that's what was foremost in my mind, is sharing the factual information and letting people come to their own conclusions. So in dealing with the Hill, dealing with others, we had those questions back and forth. So I'm not particularly surprised that the Republicans would sit that way. I am concerned as it.
You mean that the Republicans would be bashing the FBI in public today, but privately?
Yeah, because I've known them to be, as I just said, that way in the past over the last 30 years. I've been out for a while, but certainly dealing with them over the course of 20 years of my career, that was often the case. So that's not surprising in and of itself. What is troubling to me is that throughout my 29 years in the FBI, it was so rare that I ever heard somebody express personal opinions in the context of an investigation, because it was about getting the job done. And that was the focus. And I think that's particularly troubling, and I'm sure we'll get into it further, with the nomination of Kash Patel, because he, and I have his book, I haven't completed it yet, but I have his book, Government Gangsters, and for somebody to have so many strong personal opinions and not necessarily based on fact, not necessarily based on personal experience, is troubling to me.
Yeah, I mean, the title of Patel's book is Government Gangsters. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of all that implies. I mean, gangsters are mafioso, to take one example, or, you know, Mexican drug cartels, Colombian cocaine cartels and so on. These would be murderous people. So to call the government, and particularly the FBI, gangsters is kind of carrying a lot of baggage, it seems to me, at the very least, going into his confirmation hearings. I guess you have to attribute, and many people do attribute a lot of this to Republicans in fear of offending Trump, who has made it very clear that if you get out of line, he's going to come after you. And in politics, the way you come after somebody, or the way Trump does it, is to find someone, you know, a MAGA person to run against you in a primary. This is not a very flattering picture of these Republicans right now, who are, you know, falling over themselves to get in line with Trump on some of these crazy nominees like Patel. He's not a person who's qualified to run an FBI going in with such negative attitudes to start with. But, you know, the FBI is a big organization and does a lot of sophisticated things beyond catching spies, right? I mean, they're involved in money laundering investigations, very sophisticated bank transactions and so on, counter-espionage, which is infiltrating the adversary's intelligence services, and on and on and on. But let's just deal with one of the things that Kash Patel says he's going to do. He's going to shut down the FBI headquarters and turn it to a museum of the deep state and banish 7,000 special agents out to the field to catch criminals, which is, you know, off by many degrees, since catching criminals is basically the job of state, local, municipal police. The FBI is called in only on particular interstate crimes or terrorism. So are you talking to anyone in the Bureau these days yourself, or in the alumni club? What are you hearing?
Yeah, there's a lot of concern. And I would put it into two buckets. First of all, is qualifications. And I have read some of the pro Patel op-eds that are out there in terms of his qualifications. And yes, he served in several different roles in the Trump administration. That's absolutely accurate. But in terms of managing an organization the size of the FBI, you know, 35,000 plus employees all around the globe, and also being able to recognize that you have to stay independent. That is the one thing since the death of Hoover that has been able to set the FBI in its own category is its insistence on its independence. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't things that need correcting. We constantly need to correct, and there's constantly improvements that need to be made, whether it's to the FISA process or to other administrative functionings within the Bureau or how we predicate investigations. All of that's really important. So I think when you get somebody who's too focused on the politics and is not qualified, in my opinion, to do the job, it's problematic. You know, the rank and file, I would separate probably the rank and file perspective and the executives, because the executives, I think, fully appreciate what could happen. And, you know, as you mentioned in an earlier email exchange we have, one of my former colleagues has said, and I would concur with this, that certain executives who are in a position to retire, which means they have their 20 years or they're approaching their 20 years, are certainly considering that. But I also see that as a more general trend over the last six or seven years, is typically an agent would stay in his or her position until what we called mandatory retirement, which is currently 57. What we have seen much more over the last 6 to 8 years, and I don't have specific numbers to give you, but it's certainly anecdotal, that those who are going the minute they hit their 20 years, I think those numbers have gone up. So to me, that could be changes in the economy. It could be the concern over what's happened since the first Trump administration and the vulnerability that certain executives might feel. Andy McCabe was a colleague and a friend during his during both our tenures in the FBI, and watching what happened to Andy was disturbing on so many levels to a lot of different people. Now, I would say that the rank and file, however, and I probably much like in the CIA, they're not going to jump out at this point. They're going to wait and see. And as you get farther away from the executive level, who the director is, honestly, in your day-to-day life, doesn't matter, right? You have a job to do. You're doing your job every day, whether you're an analyst, surveillance specialist, linguist, tech wizard, whatever you're doing your job. And who the director is, and what at this point, it's only been he, and what he says or does, does it impact you?
That's somebody you read about in the paper. That's somewhere off in Washington.
Right.
So you're doing bank robbery cases, and you pick up the paper or you go online and you read the FBI director this or that, and you go, oh, well, you know, back to work. I got things to do.
Exactly. And so I think you would find that today.
Yeah. So, however, there were pockets of anti-Hillary Clinton sentiment in the Bureau as well, you know, widely reported in the New York field office, or New York division it's called, during the 2016 campaign, who, according to one version, forced the director to talk, you know, go public with reopening an investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails that doomed, I think you could say, doomed her chances to become president. So do you think there are going to be pockets of pro-Trump people who will, you know, carry out questionable legal activities on his part or shut down investigations that might touch on President Trump's personal life?
I'd like to think not, but the FBI is a large organization. It's representative of society, so it stands to reason just by the numbers that there will be, and there are, people who are supportive of the president. A colleague who recently wrote a book that was just published in the last couple of months. And you find that a lot of folks that were in during my tenure and coming out either before me or after me have described the Bureau as being too politically correct. And that's not something that I found to be the case. There's certainly that aspect, and it was about treating people equally and fairly. But there is absolutely a whole group of people that thinks that the FBI should have stayed the way it was and didn't make change and not make change after 9/11. So to go back to your question, Jeff, I do think that there are some people who would believe that, but the good in me and the agency that I know is that I hope with all my heart that what I saw over the course of 29 years and then engaging since then is that they will do the right thing and keep their personal views out of it.
Well, as I say, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. We have oversight committees in the House, and Senate Judiciary Committees, not just the Intelligence Committee, committees on both sides right. of the Capitol Hill, who are supposed to keep an eye on the FBI and make sure it's doing the right thing. It hasn't always succeeded. There was in-depth reporting at the New York Times a few years back about the FBI in general, agents in particular, harassing Muslims, you know, doing home visits. They essentially put them on no-fly lists, you know, and they hadn't done anything wrong. And so that was carried out. It was very widespread practice. We go back to the Hoover years and illegally spying on anti-war groups, civil rights movements, horrible things that J. Edgar Hoover himself did to target Martin Luther King Jr., essentially encouraging him to commit suicide. These horrible things. So Bureau agents will go along with leadership when it goes off the rolls. And that's what's disturbing, because essentially the FBI is our secret police. In our system, there's checks and balances, starting with Congress, and of course the press plays a role, but the Trump people are demonizing the press right now. So it's a very worrisome time.
I agree. And I also would agree completely with your assessment, because it's something I experienced firsthand in terms of being a little bit overzealous in targeting certain groups. I certainly know what it was like after 9/11, and even coming forward to the shooting at Fort Hood, for example, with Major Hassan initially, and I was overseeing terrorism at that point in time in New York, there was an immediate default to he must be a terrorist. And I literally had conversations with executives at FBI headquarters and peers in the office in New York and said, wait a minute, let's not jump to that until we know more, and not simply make a judgment because his last name is Hassan, that somehow that is an automatic tick off to terrorism. The same thing happened with the bombing at Oklahoma City when I was working terrorism at FBI headquarters.
Yeah.
Exactly the same thing. It was just like, oh, it's terrorism, it's the Iranians, it's the Palestinians. And there was a default to that. So you're absolutely right. And that is something that troubled me during my career. And while I've said that I hope for the best, I know it's there because it's something that I pushed back on myself at times and found at times frustrating. Fortunately, it wasn't a daily occurrence, but it happens.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a second. Okay, we're back now with Lauren Anderson. There has been, and this is just a fact, there has been an upsurge in right-wing extremist violence over the past several years, to the point which I think Director Ray himself said that this is the greatest threat we face, is domestic extremist terrorism, not Islamist terrorism. And when DHS tried to tackle that under the first Trump administration, they got whacked aside as being politically correct or whatever the term was used, saying they were going after conservatives. So I think we can safely predict, unfortunately, that the Bureau's tracking of right-wing domestic terrorists is going to be not a priority under Kash Patel or any FBI director that Trump would appoint.
I think there's the risk of that. I recently gave a presentation in November on domestic extremism in the D.C. area and discussed it, talked a little bit about the history in terms of when right-wing extremism started, when left-wing extremism started in this country, how that's moved forward and what that looks like today. I think that you're right that there may be an attempt to de-emphasize that. However, what you cannot change is when things happen. when events happen, when shootings happen, if there's any other criminal activity that happens that's clearly coming from the right. Because the direct array is right. If you look at the statistics compiled by agencies and organizations that are independent of the U.S. government, and in some instances, not even in the United States, the data is there. You can't argue with the factual information about when violence occurs, when it doesn't, what are the circumstances. So that I think that I would hope that the guardrail that might be in place, even if there was an effort to de-emphasize when that criminal behavior occurs, you can't simply ignore it.
Just the FBI Agents Association, which has long been sort of a shadow lobbying group for the Bureau and its interests, much of which, you know, refer to, you know, the health and welfare of FBI agents, active or retired. Do you think the FBI Agents Association will have a role to play here in keeping the FBI on the straight and narrow?
I don't know. Yes, you're right in the sense that it has a federal, as does the Society of Former FBI Special Agents, in terms of engaging with the Hill and lobbying, if you will, although lobbying is not permitted by any onboard employee, to advocate for the population of employees in the FBI. So they generally, they advocate for things that impact, as you said, quality of life. Like one of the things they're looking at now is working on legislation that causes the reduction of Social Security benefits, to get a little wonky, to FBI personnel because of pensions. So there are things like that in play, but they have to do with quality of life. The Agents Association has to be very careful because they are, although I am a member as a former agent, it's largely onboard agents. The Society of Former Agents of the FBI is a little bit different. They're in a position, I think, a little bit more so because everybody, the majority of the membership is outside the FBI. You know, there's a different set of rules in play there. I do feel that they have been outspoken, the Agents Association has, and former members there, in terms of the need to address domestic extremism. And that, I mean, this is some of the first stuff I worked in the FBI as a very young agent was domestic extremist activities, interestingly, by the Jewish Defense League and the Jewish Defense Organization. So this battle, I think this is an important point to mention, too. The politicism of domestic extremism has been in play for over 40 years. And throughout that time, the FBI has attempted through various means to suggest that there might be consideration given to creating domestic terrorism statutes as exist for international terrorism. And that is the one place where I have seen the political hand come in, mostly outside the FBI with the Department of Justice, but come in and try and say, no, deal with what it is, because you've got the program, as you know, I think, Jeff, it's split. It's more than bifurcated. It's really trifurcated with some of those offenses falling under civil rights, some falling under clear criminal activity, and it makes it difficult. But it has always been a political situation that has stopped the ability to create legislation to address domestic terrorism or domestic extremist activity when it goes into criminal activity.
Yeah, there's been a lot of strenuous debate over that through the years. I remember there was a very strong move at one point. I think the governor of Virginia back in the day was for creating an MI5, a separate organization to deal with domestic subversion, like Britain's MI5. Where do you come down on that?
That's a great question, because that came up again after 9/11 when I was running the FBI's office in Paris, France, out of the U.S. Embassy, and I was responsible for all of Francophone Africa. So 22 countries in Africa, plus France and Monaco. And that exact issue came up, and I actually hosted congressional delegations who had come to France, because the French have a similar system to the Brits and to the Canadians, where they bifurcate that role. And of course, I dealt with the other services on a regular basis, and every single entity said, don't do that, because fix things that have to be fixed in the FBI, do not bifurcate it. And I fall clearly on that side too, because we are, the FBI as an agency can be much more effective. It has to pay attention to the guardrails, but it can be much more effective having those different roles combined in one place, because the French, the Canadians, the British all found themselves hamstrung at different points in all kinds of investigations because of that bifurcation.
Let's drill down on it a little bit. So what's the argument that they made to you based on their own long experience, the Brits, the French, etc.? What's their argument against creating an MI5 in America?
The argument had somewhat to do with what we used to call the wall that existed back before 9/11, where criminal information and intelligence information gathered and national security information couldn't hop the wall, according to Department of Justice regulations. And so you literally walled off who was working on what, and they couldn't share information. That's certainly part of it. Right. That's a big part of it, because it hamstrings you in your ability to do things. So, for example...
But that's gone now. That wall was demolished.
Exactly. But if you go back to the idea of splitting the FBI, you're going to have that again, because you're going to have intelligence gathering going on within one side that can't be shared with the other, because they're now, theoretically, two separate agencies. And I watched day by day in France, in the almost 5 years I worked there, the challenges they had when they were working something on what used to be called the DST, that's now morphed into another organization, but they had no arrest authorities. So they would work an investigation jointly with us, and we would be working parallel with different agencies in France on the same thing. But the minute, for example, in the French system, they have an investigating magistrate who's kind of a mix between a judge and a prosecutor in the U.S. system. The minute that step's taken, it gets moved to another group of people to manage. And this created interesting dynamics for the Americans, because both the CIA and the FBI dealt with the agency up until that point. And then when they got to the point where they said, we're going to talk to the investigating magistrate in France, the CIA gets cut out. No more conversation on the case. And the FBI is the only ones that can stay engaged legally on what's going on. Now, as a practical matter, of course, whatever I learned or my colleagues learned, we'd go back and brief the station. But that also created that kind of bifurcation, which happens in the other countries, too, when it comes to what the CIA can get, what the FBI can get, and where the CIA is then cut out, where you might be having a joint relationship.
Mm-hmm. And there are natural tensions between investigating and arresting. Counter-espionage agents want to keep following a trail that leads up to the very top of the adversary's organization. And the law enforcement people say, no, we got a threat here. We got to start arresting people. That's an oversimplification, but that's one of the issues. Before we go, I want to touch on a problem or a challenge that Director Ray, outgoing Director Chris Ray, has raised several times, is Chinese espionage. Mm-hmm. You know, we have this mind-blowing situation right now, news breaking that Chinese hackers have infiltrated our entire telecommunication system. People could be listening to my phone, or more likely your phone, or you know, eavesdropping on your texts and emails and so on. I mean, this is unacceptable. Let's put it that way. Chris Ray has talked about X number of Chinese espionage cases opening every day. Mm-hmm. In your view, from your past experience and your current links to inside the building and other agents, is the FBI capable of dealing with Chinese, this massive challenge of Chinese espionage?
They're certainly capable of dealing with it. It becomes partly a resource issue as well. And that's something we're going to have to watch.
You mean you just need more agents?
Right. And hopefully this
meaning
is
Meaning they got to go to the Hill. They got to go to the Hill and get more money to hire more agents.
Well, yes, that depends theoretically. That depends on the numbers that are there, because the positions are funded. This is also very wonky, but the positions on the national security side are funded out of one pot of money in Congress, and the criminal agents are funded out of another pot of money coming out of Congress. So I absolutely think they're capable. I worked against the Chinese target for years of my career, and it's been something that has been not given sufficient attention over the course of decades. I do think Director Ray, I do think Director Mueller, it was too short a time with Director Comey, and I didn't personally work with him to speak about that. But it's a very, very real issue, and it has to be addressed. And I think part of the reason we've gotten to the point where we are is that it was under-addressed for too long. The people who worked to the Chinese target in the CIA, in the FBI, anywhere else in the federal government, they were well aware. And it's kind of like screaming into the wind, Jeff, if you want to use that analogy of saying, hey, there's this problem. I can remember being in Africa and saying, hey, we got to pay attention. The Chinese are taking over the telecommunications industries in North and West Africa. They're bringing weapons in. They're doing this. They're doing that. They're funding all these activities. And it's going to come and it's going to get to us. It's going to bite us at some point. And I was literally told, we can't worry about rat right now. We have to be focused on terrorism. And I said, this is a huge issue. And the CIA chiefs of station, who were my colleagues, and I wrote report after report back in the early 2000s, going up to the 10s, and saying, this is a real problem. So I think as a government, we have not kept our eye on that ball over the buildup of time. And we find ourselves where we are now. And to be fair, part of it is certainly a resource issue. Part of it is a political will issue, and you have to deal with what's in front of you. But I think this is also the accumulation of not paying attention for too long in terms of their buildup, their ability to technically evolve, largely through theft of our own IP and the IP of other well-developed nations. And so to a certain degree, we've put ourselves in this situation.
I think we can rightly fear that under a Trump Justice Department and FBI, they're not going to be screaming for more money. I mean, Cash Patel has made it clear his priority is cutting down the FBI, trashing it. He says turn headquarters into a museum and get rid of 7,000 agents, disperse them to the field. I mean, all that's totally impractical. But still, if the will is there, that will dominate the leadership of the Justice Department, the FBI for the near future, and they won't be paying attention to Chinese espionage. But prior to this time, why isn't that? I can see why, in the, let's say, the first 10 years after 9/11, mm-hmm. where terrorism would be the focus. It was all consuming. It was distorting the entire government, this fight against terrorism, foreign terrorism. But now, I mean, for several years now, the lights, to use the cliche, the lights have been blinking red about Chinese espionage. You look at the latest Chinese fighter jets and so on, they are copies of our warplanes. Mm-hmm. We have day after day reports and indictments and so on of Chinese for stealing our industrial and military secrets and now infiltrating our entire telecommunication system. Why aren't people on the Hill screaming? It seems that, we have these flurry of news reports that alarm us, national security reporters, and alarm veterans like yourself. But other than that, it just seems to be another passing story. I don't hear a sense of alarm on the people who control on behalf of the people who control the purse strings on the Hill. Or for that matter, the White House. I see statements out of the White House saying, this is a horrible situation. But I don't see the people who control the money and the resources saying this is a national emergency.
I agree with you.
I don't get it.
One of the other things that I do now post the FBI is I serve as an advisor to the U.S. Comptroller General at the Government Accountability Office. So what that means as a practical matter is, yes, I'm there to be an advisor to him, but I'm also there to be a resource on projects that they work on. And, as you know, they're a nonpartisan agency that takes most of its tasking from Congress, but they are our watchdog entity in the federal government, and they do a great job if given the opportunity. And one of the things that we've expressed to the Comptroller General, Gene Dodaro, who's phenomenal, he's a phenomenal leader, he's a phenomenal human being, and he's done a remarkable job leading GAO over the past 14 years. But that's one of the things we brought up. Every single advisor in the room, and you have people who are former cabinet officials, who are in academia, who are physicians, who are scientists. And the single thing that we all agree on coming from our different perspectives and our different careers and entities is that Congress is too focused on, and I'm making a very broad generalization, but Congress is too focused on their own partisan views and supporting somebody without, and I'm not saying this is just President Trump. This is bipartisan. They need to be there to recognize they're there to support the people. They're not there to advance their personal agendas. And I think that balance, which has always been in play, you know this for decades, you're always going to see that going back and forth. But what's troubling to us is that in the last, I would say, 8 years, thereabouts, it has been so focused on what's right for me when I'm running for office and I'm just going down this road that they forget that they actually have a job to do, which is support, was represent the population, number one. And number two, keep the government functioning. And in the years that I dealt with the whole budget side of things, we passed budgets every year by the end of the fiscal year. That hasn't happened in so long that I think that this is something that Congress needs to look at itself at and realize they're not doing their job. I haven't seen the numbers, but when I last looked, this current session of Congress may go down in history as the second most unproductive Congress in the history of our country.
Feckless. Feckless is the word that comes to mind. You know, I have lots of conversations about things like this with my fellow national security reporters, all of us who are quite long in the tooth at this point. And there comes a point where, you know, a silence fills the room or around the table over dinner or whatever. And we just say, you know, we're fucked.
Yeah.
We're fucked. Where are you on that spectrum?
I am forever an optimist, all right? I've seen the worst things that human beings do to other human beings around the world. There's like nothing I haven't seen that's horrible that people do to each other. But I still really am optimistic and hopeful. And I know there's a lot of goodness out there. And I am perpetually hoping that people who are in there for doing the right thing will do the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, when we see people like Will Hurd and certain others step out of Congress, people that are effective, it's troubling because Adam Kinzinger, I mean, Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney and I, there's a lot of things I would never agree on, but my goodness, do I have respect for her and how she conducts herself and how she viewed her job when she was on the Hill. Phenomenal.
There's really no alternative to hope and to keep trying. You can't just curl up in a ball. We can't. You and your role and me and my role. And I mean, we just got to keep trying to do get the right ending. And we'll make mistakes along the way, but again, what's the alternative?
I want to give you one really positive thing too. There's a young woman that I met.
Oh, good.
Yes, she's great. And I'm going to give her a shout out. She worked at the State Department for a little over a decade, then came out and has been working in really, really important work surrounding education and children in New York City. And she was asked by Governor Hochul if she would fill a seat of a man who vacated his assembly seat. And she was appointed as an interim and then ran for office. And she has been elected to that assembly seat with over 80% support going to the New York State Assembly. And her name is Emerita Torres. She's phenomenal. She is the kind of person, whether she stays in New York State, whether she moves onward, whether she goes back into the federal government, but her lived experience, what she brings to it, her hope, her integrity, her ethics. These are the kind of people we want to see getting into government at all levels, whether it's local levels going on to school boards, whether it's in state assembly houses, whether it's in the federal government. These are the kind of people that we want to see and that we want to support, because we have more Emerita Torreses, we have more others like her, then we have a chance of having a much more effective and functioning legislature at every level of our government in this country.
We have a former CIA officer who's about to take a Senate seat from Minnesota.
Yes.
We have a former CIA officer who is a member of Congress at present, but is leaving her seat to run for governor of Virginia.
Abigail Spanberger.
We're on the Spy Talk podcast. There's some hope in Michael Walsh, the Florida congressman, mm-hmm. who's becoming national security advisor under Trump, that he'll be a guy with guardrails because he's former Green Beret, has worked on the ground in counterterrorism operations, and he knows what's for.
I think Senator Rubio also, is not somebody I agree with, but Senator Rubio, I think, is the choice for Secretary of State, is also good because he gets it. He's lived on the national security side of things within the Congress for a long time, and I trust that
he believes in institutions.
And I trust that he's somebody that's going to do a good job. We're never all going to agree on anything, but I believe that he's a good choice, and I have confidence and hope, you know, that in his role as Secretary of State, and there is a play in the intelligence community, as you well know, with the State Department, that he's another person that we can count on, along with potentially Walz, for keeping guardrails in place.
Yeah, let's hope. Anyway, Lauren, thanks so much for coming on the show. Maybe we'll have you back when the wreckage, the dust clears at the FBI in 6 months. We'll see how Mr. Patel is doing. It's going to be interesting to watch, that's for sure.
It's going to be very interesting, and we also have Tulsi Gabbard, so that's another whole
Oh, my God, let's not get started on that today. Okay, thanks again, Lauren. See you around.
Thank you, Jeff.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Thanks for listening. You can find lots more interesting conversations like this one in our archives available at our home at the MSW Network or on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, mosey on over to our Spy Talk newsletter on Substack, where my colleagues and I offer fresh reporting and analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll find your way there. This week's Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And that's it. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.